from the Mutual Broadcasting System. This is STRAT, Strategic Risk Assessment Talk. Now, retired Marine Intelligence Officer and globally recognized risk expert, Hal Kempfer.
Welcome to STRAT, Strategic Risk Assessment Talk, and I had fully intended, in fact, if anyone listened to me on Live Now from Fox, I'd said I was going to talk about this burgeoning potential military action in Venezuela, and I was going to talk about some National Guard issues, things I did talk about at length on this last weekend. But with that said, there have been a series of articles, exposés in television news, LA Times, various other media outlets that I really kind of want to address. And I know you're going to say, oh God, he's going to do it again. Yes, I'm going to talk about the fires and I'm going to talk about natural disasters and specifically California. I'm going to talk about some of what I consider implicit corruption, all right, within the system, whether it's diverting money over to something else or not using the monies for the things they were intended for, or saying we're spending money for this and then taking that money and reallocating it somewhere else. Or in some cases, I've actually seen where state officials are doing things where they use their state office to put that money directly into their own pockets by rigging contracts and stuff for private firms that inexplicably they are allowed to own and operate and get paid for with funds that are administrated by the state. And for some reason, that is not illegal in California. I don't understand it, but or at least it has not been enforced in California. But I'm going to talk about some of this stuff. And I'm going to talk about this very, I would say, flawed federal regulatory regime that deals with emergency preparedness, homeland security funds. And I'm going to showcase some of the stuff that's been popping up in the news. Specifically, you may have seen multiple media outlets talking about the role of a state official and some highly inaccurate comments by the state, pointing directly to the governor, Gavin Newsom, regarding culpability and failures in preventing or mitigating the Palisades fire. The January fire in the Palisades, not to confuse it with the Eaton fire, which was also another horrific fire that occurred at the same time. The Palisades fire alone killed 12 people, destroyed 7,000 homes, and just an estimated insurable losses was about $20 billion. Together between the two fires, it may be somewhere between $40 to $50 billion. Although at the time that the fires were going, I saw estimates getting really high, saying $75, $100. I think some said $150 billion or something. I think that may have been way too high. But I will say that this is a substantial sum of money. Now, what this has caused, obviously, is, you know, you have this amount of damage and destruction, you're going to have lawyers descend, and the lawyers have descended. And there are lawyers representing the victims of the Palisades fire, and they want to depose Los Angeles firefighters that were dealing with a fire that took place prior in that same area, prior to the big fire that burned down the Palisades, and specifically shed some light on the allegations that a California State Parks official had restricted what they were doing, all right, and allowed something to occur, which then led to the reignition of that fire and that firestorm that destroyed thousands of homes and killed all those people. Now, the fire department handled a fire, the Lockman fire, on January 1st, all right, and it burned an area. It wasn't as big, obviously, as what we saw on January 7th. But there were smoldering embers that were in that fire. And at first, the state was saying, oh, no, there was no state official down there. No, it wouldn't happen. And then some videos showed up that showed literally that state official walking the fire line with the firefighters. And it's like, yeah, it's okay, so you're saying he wasn't there. He was specifically there. And they really wanted to put some scrutiny on what happened there, because that fire, you know, obviously, when the winds came in, you know, gusting, you know, 100 miles an hour or whatever, that's what sent that fire rolling down that hill into the Palisades area, causing that massive devastation. These attorneys have been working to try and put focus on what did the California State Parks role in this fire really involve, all right? They say a state agency didn't do enough to monitor what was going on. The area was not safe, that the firefighters and you know, the firefighters, after the firefighters said the fire had been contained, but there are indications that the state may have said, okay, great, you're done. Now, why would the state do something like that? I could tell you why. If it's on state land, then the state probably has to pay for those firefighters, you know, whether LA County or LA City, if they're up there doing stuff. So there would be a logical imperative by the state's parks to say, great, fire contained. Oh, a little smoke over here, still embers burning, whatever. Yeah, but we don't want to pay for anymore. Let's call this thing done. All right. And so there, and I'm not saying, I don't have proof that that was a discussion. I wasn't sitting there in the room. But having done this for many, many years, that is almost always part of the discussion, which is they're looking at ways to contain costs. I can tell you, in the incident command system, which is a nationwide system for how we manage this stuff, you know, when you talk about a mobilization for when you have an incident command set up and you set up this huge structure, in the doctrine, as soon as you start to mobilize, you immediately start to build plans for demobilizing for any incident. And that includes smaller incidents like the Lockman fire, that there would be a desire to do that. They say that the fire scar, if you will, the burn scar, and was not completely safe. All right. They say the state, now obviously what everything I'm saying here, yes, is very political. You know, look, California is what they refer to as a one-party state. All right. There's one party that dominates the governor's office, the legislature, and with that said, if there's anything that happens in California that's bad for state government, boom, it immediately becomes political. And yes, GOP members of Congress are scrutinizing what's been happening there. But there are some real questions about that. For example, there was a bulldozer that was up there that was used for mopping up the fires, and that was pointed to. But as a former assistant chief for LA Fire, who oversaw their wildfire tractor unit, you know, Patrick Butler was talking about, he says, look, those are great tools for building fire lines, for fire breaks, and things like that, but they're not so great for mopping up. And so there is a question of, well, did you shortcut what you needed to actually effectively mop up that fire and put that area at risk? That's a big question there. All right. In the LA Times reported last October that a battalion chief had ordered his firefighters to pack up their hoses and leave the burn of that area that day, even though there were folks on the ground that were complaining that there was still smoldering of stuff out there. As they're getting into it, more and more is coming out. Where did that order ultimately emanate from? And the question is, was that a tactical decision with the firefighting unit, or were they directed to do so by that state official? And that's what they're digging into now. And a lot of questions on this. Now, when the fire began, was Governor Newsom talked about he had deployed 110 fire trucks, that they had deployed all these fire crews, hand crews down to Southern California to deal with this thing. And it sounded very impressive. However, everyone noticed that there was actually some big fires. The issue gets into, okay, you send them to Southern California. They didn't go to the Palisades area, obviously, and they weren't, and that's something that's been brought up in this whole thing. And the question is how they get down there. And now you're getting into an area, which is an area I spent many years of my life working, which is consequence management. You're getting into the area of what was the disaster? How were you planning for the disaster? How did you do this? And I did this for years. I ran a joint military intelligence fusion center that did a lot of civil military intelligence production aimed at consequence management, initially aimed at weapons of mass destruction, but then it started dealing with natural disasters and other things. And we did that for years, running that fusion center. And then later on, I was a director of intelligence for a big multinational joint task force after 9/11, deployed overseas, focused on consequence management. And so this is an area I know quite well. And one of the things within this area is you look at a lot of stuff, like any military intelligence stuff, you look at the big three: weather, enemy, terrain, what we call WET, it was the acronym. And then every time I turn around, someone is adding another letter to the acronym. But you look at the terrain, All right. You look at the weather. In this case, you got these massive wind storms coming in. You look at the vegetation on the ground. With the vegetation, you also look at how dry it is. You look at possible sources for ignition of a fire. You look at, you know, various, you know, channels that fire would go. And look, this would not be something where you just pull it out of the air. You're talking to folks who've worked with fires. You're working with them. You're trying to build a very responsive dynamic intelligence product, which is going to support timely, effective decisions on where to deploy assets. And it's difficult, tough work. Planning for crisis action is difficult, tough work. I've trained staffs around the country and around the world on how to do this. It is a challenging thing. We spend days and days and days training them on how to do this stuff and how to incorporate and drive intelligence production to meet their decision-making requirements. And it's not easy. And this is something that takes a lot of work. Anyway, there were some other considerations there. The Santa Ynez Reservoir that has the big water source to provide water for firefighting was empty. It was down for maintenance. Now, one could say, well, you know, that's a horrible thing. Yeah, but was that incorporated into their planning process? Was that incorporated into their decision-making process early on? And if it was, you look at other water sources in the area and you might say, hey, since these guys are out of commission, we may want to spend some money and pre-deploy and put some, you know, I can think of a lot of different ways. You could put these massive water bladders up on the hill. You could do a lot of things, but you need to think about that beforehand. That gets into prevention and mitigation that you need to focus on well before. And obviously, that was, to put it lightly, under-assessed. And so does this mean that Gavin Newsom was lying or obfuscating or whatever he was doing? I don't know. I would say more likely than not, he was probably just saying things that were being fed to him, because that's usually what governors do. Within that Office of Emergency Services, there might have been some CYA, so to speak, some mischaracterization, trying to make themselves look better, trying to make the state look better, things like that. But of course, at the end of the day, under the bright glare of other things, it kind of put the governor in a very difficult situation. Makes it look like he's not being forthcoming. Maybe he's trying to cover up stuff. And I'm not saying that maybe he isn't, but I'm just saying that there are staffs that feed them that information. Now, let me take you back a little bit. There is a historic problem, though, that goes back a few years, back in 2021. January 2021, a Capital Public Radio, NPR's National Public Radio's California Newsroom, did a joint investigative reporting thing where they found that the governor had misrepresented his accomplishments in terms of what they were doing to prevent fires and had even disinvested from wildfire prevention. They found that he had overstated the number of acres treated with what they call fuel breaks. That's basically fuel being the fuel on the deck, which is the vegetation on the deck, forestry, brush, everything else. That's what they mean by fuel when you talk to fire, when you talk about fires. That he had overestimated all the stuff he'd done to include prescribed burns by a mere 690%. All right. That's quite a bit. Basically, they were supposed to work on 90,000 acres, and at the end of the day, they actually worked on a little over 11,000 acres. And that a lot of the money that was supposed to go to that, $500 million, $1 billion, had been rerouted to other things. All right. So they're talking about these 35 priority projects. They're a big deal. I would recommend anybody look this up to see what happened with this stuff. And then also go back to talking about Jerry Brown, when he was governor, had a plan which mandated the state to reach a goal plan to treat 500,000 acres a year by 2025. And that's what Newsom said he was going to do. Well, that goal was supposed to be in 2018 when they were supposed to, by 2023, a couple of years before. So they're well behind. So when you talk about why aren't we where we should be in 2025, well, the problem is we're at least a couple of years behind on where we ought to be. What this means is that a lot of money that was supposed to be spent on this stuff was reallocated to other things. And that this is a problem that goes back many, many years. All right. Now, where does consequence management intelligence come from? You may recall there was a Aum Shinrikyo did the big attack with sarin gas. They also did an anthrax attack. They were trying to build a nuclear bomb over Japan in 1995. You may also recall that Terry Nichols and Timothy McVeigh did this amphibomb attack on the Oklahoma City, a federal building, the Murrah building, basically destroying the entire thing. That was a high-yield explosive, very high-yield explosive device. And then if you go back to Hurricane Andrew swept through southern Florida, completely wiped out a Homestead Air Force Base, just caused massive devastation, which was a real wake-up call for everybody. And then if you also look in 1992, you'll see that there was a Joint Task Force Los Angeles that was sent that involved military, Marines, and Federalized National Guard. And there may have been, I believe Army came down, 7th Infantry Division, to Los Angeles to deal with the riots after the Rodney King trial. And then there was, in 1993, there was this massive flooding across the Missouri and Mississippi rivers in multiple states. Hundreds of levees had failed. Anyway, all of this stuff was happening through the early to mid-90s, and by the latter 90s, it was pretty apparent to the military that we were going to get called in to do things to help deal with the consequences of these major disastrous events, whether they be from an intentional man-made weapon of mass destruction or from some natural disaster or something else, that was something we had to be prepared to do. And the big combatant commands, or COCOMs, as we call them today, they had to all have, for the geographical combat commands, they had to have a plan of an embedded contingency joint task force that would be ready to go, that they could set up on short order to go in and deal with this consequence management stuff. I worked with the ones for U.S. Central Command. I worked with the ones for U.S. Pacific Command at that time. And later I dealt with another one for Pacific Command, and I dealt with a big joint task force called JTF Civil Support that was here in the U.S. working on this as well. And a lot of my work was focused on intelligence support. So I have a long background in this, and that's a way of saying that we knew this was something we had to be good at. All right. And so the Department of Defense developed a lot of capabilities, particularly in the area of intelligence, because, well, frankly, we do intelligence in a level, degree, manner that is well beyond anything you see with our state and local counterparts. All right. And I don't mean any disrespect to the National Guard, but frankly, big DOD does intelligence very well. And we incorporated that within these JTF consequence management things. It wasn't seamless. I will tell you there are fits and starts, and I won't get into all the bureaucratic wars on that, but there was a lot of stuff going on. Anyway, that added impetus to a lot of the folks that knew about this were moved over to DHS, and they recognized that we need to have that capability working with emergency operations throughout the United States. And they put together a thing called Comprehensive Preparedness Guide 502, which is essentially a mandate, some would say directed guidance, whatever you want to call it, that says go out and do this stuff. And the state in 2011, this thing was being implemented with the DHS-sponsored Intelligence Fusion Centers in California. And then end of 2011, early 2012, state officials shut it down. And the reason they shut it down was because the funding was going someplace other than back to the state from the local entities. In other words, the state would administer the DHS funding and go down to LA. LA was spending the money, but they weren't spending it on hiring the state to provide these services. Therefore, the state said, well, we got to stop that. And at the end of it, less than a year later, I actually saw the exact amount that they kiboshed from implementing this program that showed up as something that they had moved over within California Office of Emergency Services, actually moved over to pay a state institute and literally dropped the state requirement or the state obligation for paying for that activity. So it was like a direct correlation. They took the money that was meant to do this. Anyway, that's another way of saying there's a reason why we don't have this intelligence capability. Subsequent years, states like Texas and Florida wanted to set up the same thing. In this convoluted DHS system, which is truly a mess, they had to call California. I know you're saying, well, how did that work? Yeah, that's a mystery there. Somehow they delegate California to be the lead on this thing. And California told them, no, you can't do it. And so when I look at the Hill Country floods in Texas that recently happened, and I trace some of the decision failures, some of the preparedness failures, some of the things going on there, I can directly look back at this and say, yeah, there's a direct lineage back that goes back, 13, 14 years as to what happened. Anyway, so what does this all mean? What it means is that this is not just a Southern California thing. This is not just a civil litigation issue by some private attorneys representing homeowners in Pacific Palisades. This is a much bigger problem. This is a much more endemic problem, not just to California. I'm sure other states are doing the same thing, but it needs a massive federal investigation. Now, with this, I know DHS, Department of Homeland Security, Office of Inspector General, knew all about this stuff, and they punted. They did not want to look into it. From what I gathered way back when, they were scared. This was a political hot potato, and at the time, they didn't feel it was politically comfortable to do it. I would say at this time, what they really need to do is to get the FBI in here and take a look at this. This is much bigger than some attorneys, trying to do discovery. This is something that needs to be dealt with on a different level. Anyway, that is my very political statement on that. Thanks for listening to Strat. Thanks for staying tuned with our YouTube channel, and I'll talk to you next time.